internet. So tax season has rolled around again, and let's be honest, it is nobody's favorite time of year, especially in Texas, where property taxes, although not due yet, they do have property valuations that are going to be coming out really soon. And these upcoming bills seem to be the most grumbled about and least understood of them all. So today we are dragging you kicking and screaming through the exciting world of property taxes. And this is the Texas Real Estate and Finance Podcast. And I'm your host, Mike Mills, a North Texas mortgage banker with Geneva Financial and your tour guide through the confusing maze that we call this wonderful real estate industry. So imagine this: you or your client finally sealed the deal on that perfect dream home, only to be greeted a year later by a completely unwelcome surprise, a hefty tax bill that skyrockets your mortgage payment by hundreds of dollars each month. Are you surprised? Are you disappointed? Well, you are in good company. It is a very common story across the state, especially around tax season. So today we are peeling back the curtain to reveal why this happens and, more importantly, how you can prevent it from happening to you. Now, by the way, if you managed to sit through our tax adventure today without dozing off, first off, congratulations. Second, how about showing some love? Like, comment, or share this episode. It helps more than you know. Plus, let's face it, building a podcast audience is tougher than explaining tax codes to a toddler. So your involvement helps an old bald man have a reason to come back next week. So I appreciate each one of you being here, and please share it if you love it. So now, in the realm of taxes, there are those who teach, and then there is Dr. Blake Bennett, who brings a whole new level of flair to the economics of everyday life. As an associate professor and economist at Texas A&M, he's got the know-how to break down complex tax concepts into bite-sized, digestible, and yes, even enjoyable pieces. And he's here today to dump his brain on us. So please welcome to the podcast, Dr. Bennett. How are we doing, Dr. Bennett?
Not much of a pressure there that you put on me.
No.
You want an economist to be entertaining and keep people away. That's the core.
Well, that's what I heard about you. Is you have a flair for it. So I think even in our brief conversation here beforehand, I think this is going to be great because everybody hates taxes. It's nobody's favorite friend. And to pretend like it's an exciting topic is being disingenuous. So it is not exciting, but it is certainly something that if you don't understand it and you don't know it, it can come around and bite you in the butt pretty hard. So, it's necessary evil sometimes to bite the bullet and understand how all this stuff works, because most of my audience is realtors, real estate professionals, and them being able to explain this to their clients as they go into buying new construction, buying homes, that people have lived in for a long time. These are all the kind of things that they need to be able to forewarn their clients about, because as you'll explain, I'm sure, at the end of the day, there's nothing we can really do too much about the taxes. You got to pay what you got to pay, but sure, you got to be prepared and you got to be aware. So, first off, how did you get into, I know you're at A&M University as a professor there, but how did you get into the tax circuit, going around talking to folks about property taxes?
Well, I'm in the Dallas office. I am associated with A&M, but I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. Okay. Our job is to do outreach education to the public. So that is my normal job that I've been doing. It's 1999. About 7-8 years ago, I started getting into working with the real estate industry. Okay. Traditionally, I work with landowners. And we noticed, these landowners, they're having the same questions year after year after year. We're seeing the same ones time and time again. And I thought, it would be nice if we could segue in and catch them earlier. And that means let's work with real estate and let the real estate profession know that we actually exist, and we provide assistance. We answer questions. We do education. So started working with real estate, and then it's just grown from there. And we have several classes that we teach. I'm booked up pretty much all the time, working all over the state at this point. I'm based in Dallas, but San Angelo's on the ticket for next week and the week after that. So it's all over the state.
So super exciting life. You get to roam around the state of Texas talking about taxes. Lucky you.
Yeah. And you know what? This time of year, it's not bad to drive around the state and see all the bluebonnets and everything that's blooming. You get in the winter months and it's kind of a tough drive, but to see a lot of the states, it's fun.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, and the people are really what makes it exciting and fun.
Yeah, you meet all kinds of different folks out there roaming around the state, I'm sure. Yep. All right, so when we do talk about taxes, everybody's favorite subject, when you talk to realtors specifically, because that's a lot of your classes are geared towards, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
So when you do that, what do you find as one of the biggest, you know, misconceptions, like just right out of the gate when you hear from people asking questions about this that you think they would understand, but generally speaking, kind of don't really get?
You know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is a trap that I fell into myself whenever I built my first home. You know, you close on the home, you move in, and the bank estimates this is going to be your payment. So, as you know, some goes to principal, some goes to interest. And then you got some that goes into escrow to help pay for property taxes and insurance. The first year that you close, chances are the full market value of that property is not being taxed. The property's probably being taxed as an unimproved lot because January 1st, the home was not livable. And so the appraisal district values it as an unimproved lot. Right. It's year two that the structure gets added. And so lenders may not pull enough into escrow to pay the property taxes based on the improvement plus the lot. And so you could see in year two, you could see your property tax bill shoot to the upside. There's not enough money in escrow. And so the bank gives you a couple of options. You can either bring it up to speed right now and cut us a big check, or we can increase your payment for the next 12 months to get escrow up to where it should be. That was a huge shock whenever I built my first house, you know, a long time ago, over 20 years ago. Yeah. It really was a shock and sent us scrambling. How are we going to come up with this extra money? And honestly, either option's not good for us. Right. At the time, what we decided to do is we refinanced 1 year in, mm-hmm, and rolled that in. And that was a chore in and of itself, cost us a little bit of money. But we didn't have another option. My mother went through the same thing, but I was prepared this time. She built a new house, moved from West Texas, and she built a home, moved down to the Metroplex. Yes, January 1, it was an unimproved lot according to the appraisal district, but I let her know this letter's coming from the lender because your escrow is not going to be, you're not going to pull enough into escrow. So get ready, start putting money aside right now because next year, you're going to get that letter and you're going to have to bring that escrow up to the level that it needs to be so you can pay your property taxes.
Now, do you see, is it a situation where with builders, do they have kind of general agreements, I guess you would call it, with the county or whatever, that when they buy the land and they're going to improve it and build property on that land, part of the incentive, I guess you would call it, for them to do so is that they don't actually have to pay improved taxes until this property is sold. Is that kind of generally how it works? So even if it sat there for a year and didn't get purchased, would they have to pay on the improved value?
No, they would. As soon as that home is deemed as livable, then it's full market value on that home.
Okay.
So that's why you'll see builders, particularly in a neighborhood, if they're going to do a spec house, boy, they want to move it as quick as possible. They would love to move it even before it's finished. Right. So because they don't want that property tax liability. Appraisal district is going to appraise the property based on the land plus the improvements. And if the improvement is a completed home and it's deemed as livable, then full value. And a builder is not going to want to sit on that for long.
Right. They want to unload it. They'll take a hit on it just so they don't have to pay the taxes on the property, basically.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You're exactly right on that.
Now, so we run into this obviously a lot, or I should say I hear about it a lot because, you know, the way it works with us as mortgage lenders with builders is, you know, it's sometimes it can be difficult to compete because builders obviously have the build and then they have the mortgage company that they work with. And what they end up doing is kind of building the cost of giving all the incentives into the actual price of the home, you know, which, you know, a lot of
you mean my mother did not get a free sunroom and she didn't get free wood floors?
Wow. I mean, you know, maybe, but probably not. There was a cost in there somewhere, but what I'll hear is when they come back, because a lot of times, you know, the lenders that work for these builders or work with these builders don't do a very good job explaining how this works, because we can set up an escrow account or at least prepare people to have the escrow account set up. So that way, you know, when those bills come due, they're going to have something. Now, we don't know, and this is what I tell people all the time, we really don't know exactly what the taxes are going to be until the house is assessed, right? We can only guess.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. And you've got an estimate as to what the final build price is going to be. Right. Now, that game kind of changed during COVID because, you know, it building materials were going up by the day. Mm-hmm. And builders in the beginning, whenever they locked in a price, say 6 months ago, this is going to be your final price. They took a hit. And so you saw a lot of builders that they weren't willing to lock in that price until it was done, because again, building materials were going up by the day.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a little bit more of a floating issue. It's starting to calm back down now, but yeah, you can get a rough estimate as to how much the final price is going to be, land plus structure, and you can get at least close as far as how much you're going to pull into escrow. So it's not that big shock.
Yeah. Well, usually like what we'll do obviously is like when we qualify someone to on a new build, if we do get the new build, which does happen, but if we get it, then we will actually, we have to qualify them on what the purchase price is and then the tax rate for that area. That's what we have to do. And then we can collect that much in escrow if we want to, or really we can collect whatever. If the borrower wants to collect it at the super unimproved value, they can do that. If they want to collect it at a higher value so they have the money, they can do that. The key is that we just have to explain to them what the ramifications are if they choose to collect at the lower premium, because that's what's going to impact them. And, you know, it's usually like 12 to 16 months when they get that bill in the mail and they're like, oh crap, you know. And, but as long as we tell them and we prepare them for it and I say, hey, look, put a little money aside because this is going to come, then for the most part, you know, they understand. It's just the preparation of it.
Yeah. And again, you know, I was ready whenever my mother built her house. I was not ready whenever I built mine.
Yeah.
And yeah, we went with the builder's lender. I mean, we got incentives to go with the builder's lender.
A lot of
and
people.
So we took them. We jumped right in the middle of it. But I can tell you that was a scary time. You know, first house that you build, you're still young, got some young children, and now all of a sudden, how are we going to come up with this extra money?
Yeah,
I don't know. And then you face a higher mortgage, you know, monthly payment after that. So you've got to make some adjustments at that point.
So this also happens on homes that have been purchased that are pre-existing homes that somebody has lived in for a very long time. So can you explain how that works too? Just as, you know, someone's buying a house that's pre-existing, it's not a new build, but yet they still have the same thing happen. It doesn't happen to the same degree, but it does happen. So can you explain how that works?
Absolutely. You know, particularly we've seen a lot of that with after the pandemic. You know, the real estate market went absolutely bonkers during the pandemic. And we've seen 30, 40, 45, 50% appreciation from 1 year to the next.
Yeah.
And there's part of the homestead exemption law that says if you declare a homestead, Mike, then your value, your taxable value cannot go up more than 10% a year.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter if the market went up 50%, your taxable value, the value that they use to multiply by the tax rates, can only go up 10% every single year. Now it can go up 10% every year until it catches market value, but it's only a 10% climb. So it's a slower climb up versus just all at once. If I buy your house and you've got that 10% cap and you're working that off, your chances are you still are.
Yeah,
the prorated taxes that I'm going to pay that first year from the time that I buy it, and let's say we close today, for the rest of the year, my proration is going to be based on your 10% cap.
Yeah.
As soon as I buy that property, then the appraisal district, that 10% cap goes away January the 1st for me. I don't get that protection January the 1st. So they will catch me up to market value January 1, and it can be a sizable increase, particularly now.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of people that are still working off, and it's 60, 70, 80,000 or more that we're going to see a rubber band effect, and it's going to jump up.
Yeah.
So be mindful of that. Your property taxes will jump to the upside.
Yeah. Whenever, that's one of the things when I talk to folks about, you know, getting pre-approved, when we look at addresses, cause I'll have them send me, you know, I'll say, hey, look, if you're looking for a house, shoot me the address. I can give you an estimate on the payment about what you can expect. So that way you'll know, you know, what's coming before you write your offer. But I also tell them, if I see on there, if you're buying a house for 400,000, and I look on the county records and I see that it's taxed at 300,000, I'm going to be like, hey, good news is for about 12 months or however long, your taxes are going to be lower at what they're at. But you need to be aware that the county's going to come in and raise that value after 12, you know, at the first part of next year. And you need to be conscious of it because it's going to hit you.
Oh, absolutely. And then let's say that, not that you are, but let's say you're over 65. Mm-hmm. You know, the value, the year that you turn 65, your value freezes for school tax purposes. Doesn't go any higher. So if you're 65, or maybe you're 70 now, 75, and I buy your home, I'm not 65 yet. I'm getting close, but not there yet. Mm-hmm. I will get a prorated taxes, property taxes, based on you being over 65 till the end of the year. Now, next year, that's lifted.
Yeah.
So my value is going to really snap, because you get some people that have maybe lived in a home for a long, long time after they turn 65. Maybe they've been there 10, 15, 20 years. Whenever they sell, their taxable value could be less than 100,000, and the house today's worth 750.
Man.
You know, and so that's a big snap.
Yeah.
After the next January 1st rolls around, and now suddenly I get it at full market value. Uh-oh, look out.
Well, I want to get into the over 65 thing a little bit, because there is a little trick that we talked about. I want you to tell everybody here in just a little bit, but we'll curb that for right now. But
I think that's called a teaser, right?
That is a teaser. Yes, we call that a teaser. but what I'm curious about is, okay, so these new exemptions that came into place this year in Texas, this was a pretty, I don't want to say a hot topic necessarily. I mean, it was debated for a while, but everybody kind of knew. I mean, you look at it across the board, and you're like, all right, we had this surplus of income for the state. And then they, you know, proposed to raise the tax or the exemption on the taxable value for your home based on the school districts and everything else. So can you explain a little bit of the history of like what happened there exactly, how this came about? And then also too, you know, what that actually is, because I don't think when people think of these exemptions, I don't know that they understand what that amount, you know, they're like, oh, you have a $100,000 exemption. It's like, well, you got to understand what that is actually impacting. It impacts the taxable value. But I just want you to go through all that for me, if you don't mind.
Okay. So whenever you pay property taxes, you've got two components there. You have your taxable value, like you mentioned. So that's what is the value of the property that we can tax.
Right.
And then you have your tax rate. The taxable value is set by the appraisal district. They're the ones that get to say, this is the taxable value.
And that's not your market value, by the way, not your market value.
No, it's not your market value. They set market value, and then your taxable value is based on what exemptions you get.
Right.
So you can take money off. Let's say a home is the appraisal district appraises or says it's worth $400,000. Well, right now, the new law is $100,000 exemption if for school property taxes. So for school property taxes, you take that value, that market value of the home, $400,000, subtract off $100,000 for school taxes, yep, multiply by the school tax rate. So yep, effectively it'll be $300,000 times that school tax rate. And that's how you calculate your school property taxes. That was the change this year, is school taxes, the school exemptions or the homestead exemption for school taxes was increased from $40,000 to $100,000. So they gave us an extra 60. Yep. You know, honestly, if you look at it, the savings that we got, $60,000 multiplied by a school tax rate, average home is going to save an additional $600 to $750, depending on what the tax rate is.
Yeah.
You know, it's nice. Market values have shot through the roof over the last few years. That's why they came in with the property tax reform. You know, my thoughts are that's good. Okay, $600-$700. Now I go to McDonald's for a family of four, maybe three times.
Right. Yeah, golly. You know,
I think that was good.
Yeah.
Another part of the reform was they, like you mentioned, you know, they got the budget surplus. They attacked the rate as well. And this happened at the state level. They attacked the maintenance and operations part of the school tax rate and forced it lower.
Okay.
Schools were screaming, hey, you're giving more of an exemption and, you know, you're gonna lower our rate. We're getting hit from both sides. And Austin decided to use some of the budget surplus money and push towards these school districts to make them whole.
Right.
So that it wouldn't be as much pain. I believe that the money's they have enough to guarantee through September 1, 2025. My question is, what happens if we don't have a budget surplus at that time, or when we don't have a budget surplus? I don't think it's a matter of if, it's when. What is the plan after that?
Yeah.
How are we going to protect these schools? Because honestly, you know, you look around, if the average home saves between an additional $600 to $750, think about every single home. You're in Mansfield. Think about every single homestead in Mansfield. I've run some estimates. I've run some numbers, and it's cutting into the potential budget of a school district anywhere from 3 to 7%. Doesn't sound like a much, but
you know, matters.
Well, I estimate Fort Worth's going to lose about $83 million from going from $40,000 to $100,000. Dallas, $72 million. You know, you go down south, you get some of your smaller school districts. Marble Falls, about $2.4 million. It's a lot of money to lose. That's a lot. And so I think that's why you saw a lot of school districts, a lot of school boards starting to scramble. And we did see a lot of bonds this past year on the ballots.
Yes.
I think that's why, because they're preparing for what happens when times are not good and we do have a budget shortfall. So school districts, school boards, they're really looking at this and how are we going to make up that difference? How are we going to still operate? You're seeing cities get involved, you know, changing their tax rate, maybe trying to buy some infrastructure for schools. We're seeing that around. You know, there's creative things that can be done, but nothing comes for free. And these school districts, they are hurting. I can say that.
Yeah, now, that was part of the thing that I noticed about that whole argument, that if you kind of read between the lines a little bit, there's this, I guess you would call it like a battle that's going on between the whole public schools and the school choice, I guess is what they call it, where, you know, the money comes and you can then self-direct your money to whatever school you choose. And, you know, depending on what side of the aisle you're on, you're like, oh, that's great. And then the other, but what it's not great is that the school districts that don't have a big budget and don't have wealthy families living in those areas, they're going to suffer the most. And then if you purposefully cut the budgets of these schools, then, you know, people start to say, oh, well, the public schools are going downhill. We can't get good teachers. We can't get good facilities. You know, they don't get new books. I'm going to take my kid and go put them in private school, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And some people don't have that option. And so it's unfortunate, because I think this seemed like, and that's why I want your opinion, because you're in knee deep in this stuff. It certainly seemed like this whole, which look, I'm all for lower taxes. I love lower taxes. It's great.
Yeah.
But, you know, it also seems like this is a long game to get us to a place, because, you know, I don't know if it's Abbott or who, it seems to be really in favor of this school choice thing. And I think it's not necessarily the best thing in the long term for Texas schools, but that's just me.
I'm a state government employee. I have no opinion whenever it comes to the part that you're talking about.
Okay, I like that.
I will talk about the exemption itself.
Okay. All right.
And we were drowning. We were drowning with the way that property values were going up.
Yeah.
We had to have something.
Yes, I agree.
I'm glad we got something. I am. I'm glad that you know, after a couple of extended sessions, I'm glad that they came up with something. Absolutely. Yeah. It did help. We're still suffering out here. I can say that because property values are still just running wild.
Yeah.
We did not crash last year. We corrected, but we're still seeing a hot market. We're still seeing multiple offers. You know, they're happening in zip codes, in hot zip codes.
No, overall the country's at a 6% growth in 2020 for 2023. I mean, every market's a little different, but you know, rates haven't slowed down because we don't have enough homes, so it keeps driving the price up.
Yeah, exactly right. And inventory is the big issue. You know, everyone kind of thought, well, you know what, rates going up, they're gonna slow us down. I think they did a little bit. They helped it. They helped the market correct, but that we haven't built inventory. I know that, you know, we've got a lot saying it's first of the year. They expected 7 rate cuts. I thought if we get 7 rate cuts, then our economy is in a serious recession. I don't want to see 7.
Well, okay, real quick on that, since you said that. So as an economist, right, I look at this and I go, okay, the Fed, or let's say the BLS, all right, I don't want to say the Fed, the BLS, who I have less faith in every single day, tells us that our unemployment rate is a certain percent, which is relatively low, although it's been ticking up, actually, even though when you look at people that have left the job market and then how they count people that are still off jobs and haven't come back and all this other stuff, that's there. Then you've got the inflation data that they compile, which depending on how you measure it, which, by the way, we've changed how we've measured it over the last 30 years multiple times. Like I've seen multiple things that said if we measured inflation at the same way we did back in like 1984, then we would be at like a 10%, you know, inflation rate or something like that. But you know, how accurate that is, I don't know. But either way, it seems like they play with these statistics quite a bit to fit whatever kind of story that seems to match what they're looking for. But the downside of that is that everybody thinks the economy's humming along, and yet Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, is still saying, after inflation's still running a little bit hot, unemployment seems to be still below that 4% mark right now, and he's still saying we still plan on cutting 3 times this year, and we're already through the first quarter almost. And so in my head, I go, okay, rates only get cut when the economy is in really bad shape. Typically, you don't see rate cuts when the stock market's at all time highs and crypto's selling through the roof and real estate's at all time highs. And yet here we are, the Federal Reserve telling us that they still plan, even after all this data, to cut rates 3 times. Now, whether they do it or not still remains to be seen. But why would they keep saying that unless they knew something about something that was coming that nobody else is, or at least the market in general, is not picking up on?
Okay, here's my take on it.
Okay.
Number one, every economics class I ever took in school, we, you know, was always taught somewhere between 2 and 4% inflation is okay. It's acceptable because inflation, right, yes, is the rise in prices over time, but it also measures how fast the economy is growing.
Yeah.
And 2 and 4% growth is acceptable. Well, if you look at current inflation, we're somewhere in the mid 3s. So why is that not okay? I believe that the Federal Reserve is looking at long-term inflation. I think that they're going back before COVID. And they're measuring, say, from January of 2019 till present, mm-hmm, we've got still an extremely high inflation rate. It's above 23-24%, meaning prices today are 24% higher than they were in January of 19.
Yeah.
If you average that out, we're still above that long-term, we're still above 4% per year. I believe that the Federal Reserve is trying to say 2%. We want 2%. And that's why they've been stuck on that number. Because if they can pull the inflation rate down to 2% and keep it there starting in March for the rest of the year, we would be back down in between that 2-4% inflation long-term average by December.
Right.
If it stays where it currently is, about 3.17, it's going to take us until about March of 26, before we get it down into that range. I think they're looking at long-term. As far as them saying they're expecting three cuts, I believe what they're looking at is the consumer. The consumer has helped keep the economy afloat through COVID because we spent money. We spent a lot of money.
Yeah, our debt's insane.
Problem is consumer debt. We've spent a lot of money on credit cards. Mm-hmm. Credit card balances, I think I saw 4.7% increase in quarter four alone of 2023.
Yep.
The delinquencies are near an all-time high.
Yep.
Then you had forbearance that came in there where we didn't have to pay mortgages. We didn't have to pay on loans during COVID, and the federal government was throwing money at us. So just like any good consumer, what did we do? We went out, we bought toys, we bought boats, we bought new cars. We increased the payment. We used that money to put a down payment down, and we still have that loan. Now suddenly we're at a point where we forbearance is gone. We got to pay that mortgage again, but we've also got all these toys that we have to pay for.
And student loans.
And I believe we're a society that is cash poor, but equity rich. I don't see foreclosures being a signal now. It's too much equity in the home. Forced sales, possibly.
Yeah.
So that's really what I'm looking for is when are we going to see forced sales? Your property taxes and your insurance just going up because market value's gone up, that could speed along the process. There's a lot of people that either refied or they bought a home during COVID and they've got a 2.75 or a 3 for their mortgage rate. Yeah. And they're saying, I'm going to die in this home. Well, you've also seen property taxes and insurance go up to a point where that monthly payment has increased $500, $600, $700, $800. And so they may be forced to move or at least to sell. And that may be what the Fed's watching. That may be where the Fed's looking is the consumer. The consumer may need a break because right now we're not just running at the wall. I think we're at the wall as a consumer.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. And when you look to at what they're talking about with unemployment, because, you know, in our industry in real estate, I always kind of call us the canary in the coal mine because we're one of the first ones to go down when things aren't going great. Yeah. But then we're also one of the first ones to turn around a little bit when things are not great because they bring rates down and then that refinances and people, you know, can buy cheaper real estate, et cetera. But when you look at the tech industry and how, you know, with AI impacting it and people getting laid off there in mass droves, well, a lot of those people that got laid off, like right now, I think California's unemployment rate is somewhere almost 6%. And that is primarily because of the tech layoffs that happened just last year. But a lot of those people got 6 to 9 months severance pay. Well, that's a long road, you know, to get to a point where you still have money coming in or you have a fair amount of money, but that money's starting to run out and you start to see consumer spending coming down. Even I read the other day, my wife and daughter love this store, but I don't necessarily go there, but Lululemon, which is a higher end clothing store, has actually started forecasting sales coming down because they were at a very high level for a long time, but now they're saying, hey, we're having a hard time. And you see companies going bankrupt. There's even Walmart has come out and said, hey, look, our earnings aren't going to be what they are expected. And one of the things, you know, you can play with numbers a lot when it comes to earnings and profit and all those kind of things. What you can't mess with is revenue. Revenue is very clear and very direct because it's just how much money did you bring in? And when you start seeing those numbers come down, which we have, that really goes to your point of, you know, we might be at that wall and maybe what the Fed is seeing is, you know, they're concerned about because now that they have the dual mandate of, you know, also with unemployment, that if that number ticks up to 4% or 4.1 or 4.2, then they're going to have a problem on their hands because that could tip things in the other direction pretty quickly. And that's maybe, at least from my point of view, just seeing this stuff, you know, when I hear Jerome Powell say they still plan to cut rates, I'm like, okay, well, that tells me that you see something coming that we, you know, nobody else does. And
And then I'm also hearing, which I don't understand, which you can explain to me a little better, is stagflation being thrown around quite a bit now. Can you explain what stagflation is exactly?
We're stagnant. The economy is not, we're not seeing inflation anymore, more stagnant.
Okay.
Going back to what you were saying with, I'm in the camp right now, I'm going to say we need to prepare for no cuts.
Really? Oh yeah. No, I could totally see that as well. I mean, absolutely.
I'm kind of leaning towards that completely. I think that the Fed's between a rock and a hard place. I think they're looking at long-term inflation, and that is one where that suggests we need to stay higher longer, or maybe even go higher. Jobs market starting to normalize a little bit. If you go higher, you're going to hurt the jobs market. You're going to hurt consumers. We really hadn't considered the fact that Japan and China have cut their ownership of bonds by nearly 40%. We need to find somebody to buy our debt. And U.S. consumers, one that can do that. The only way we're going to buy that debt and buy bonds is how we do it. The only way I'm going to pull money out of the stock market and put it into bonds is if I get a better return.
Right.
And right now, you know, sorry, the rate's just not high enough. It's starting to get close.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit more secure investment. But I mean, we hadn't even thought that direction. And if they keep rates high enough, then we start buying bonds. Well, we're buying the government's debt.
Yes. Yeah. Well, somebody's got to buy it because we've been racking it up. But that's another concerning part of it.
That's exactly right. And so I'm kind of leaning towards, I say prepare for no cuts.
Yeah, yeah.
Prepare yourself. I'm also going to say, you know, you threw out numbers and you threw out states like California, and we can throw out Nevada, we can throw out Arizona, we can throw out New York, we can throw out Florida. I'm going to say we're in Texas, and Texas, it's different here.
Yes.
We like that. We like being separate until it comes to maybe our power grid going down during a big ice storm. And then we're not so happy that we've got our own power grid.
Yeah.
But we handle economic hardships differently. So hearing problems in California, look local. You know, even your major metropolitan areas are impacted differently. Dallas-Fort Worth is still seeing a massive number of people that are moving here. And honestly, they have to live somewhere. I mean, you see houses going up everywhere. You see apartments being built everywhere. It's to house everyone that's moving here. And as we see people moving here, that means our own gross domestic product in DFW continues to increase. And I can tell you the forecast that I've done and the relationships I've seen between home price is highly correlated with gross domestic product in DFW. Mm-hmm. So it's forecasted to grow this next year. I see an increase in the price of the homes this next year.
Yeah.
Houston's gross domestic product, the value of everything that they produce, highly influences the home price in Houston.
Yeah.
Every major metropolitan area, it's that way.
Yeah, it's a shame. There's a lot of messing with numbers sometimes when you have people that are, you know, especially now with the internet and everybody posting their thoughts all the time about this big crash. Like, although there's going to be a crash, I'm like, with housing specifically, because we've been so high and they keep measuring. And there's a federal, the St. Louis Fed does a really good job of putting up different charts on questions that you ask. Well, there is a just general housing, right? And it says units available for housing, and it's higher than it was, you know, even 15 or 20 years ago. And you see folks on Twitter, and, you know, I get into little spats with them from time to time because they'll say, oh, you know, we have more supply and this just means it's all going to come down. I'm like, wait a minute. That is not homes for sale. Those are homes those are units that you can live in. That includes apartments, anything that you can rent, multifamily. That is not properties for sale. And then they'll show our new homes. They'll show, well, we're at a higher level of new home builds than we were back in 2008. And you know what? That's true, but that's only because we have so few pre-existing homes that are for sale, and they make up, you know, I think it's something like 80% of the market share, or it might be closer to 70 now, but they make up such a big piece of the market share that that individuals, you know, yeah, there are a lot of units, but those are rentals, most of them. And there are a lot of new homes for sale, but it makes up a small fraction of the market. And that still means we are well, well under supplied. And you can tell, because I just tell people, like, we went through a period of time where we were at 7 or 8% interest rates for almost a year, which is the highest that we've seen in 35, 40 years, right? With home values, the highest they've ever been, and they keep going up. So what does that tell you? That's just basic economics, right?
That's exactly right. It's supply and demand. And I always say in the classes that I teach, give me two numbers and tell me what story you want to say.
Yes.
I could find a way to say it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just, how do I want to analyze those two numbers? Weed through all of that. And what does it actually mean? For instance, during COVID, you know, DFW got down to 0.8 months, less than a month of inventory. And in 1 month's time, inventory increased by 100%. That was the headline that I saw.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it went from 0.8 months to 1.6. I mean, we're still extremely low.
Yes.
Watch what you read. Just be careful. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
You know, scare news does sell. It really does.
Yeah.
I don't see it really falling apart right now. I see correction. Mm-hmm. I see a number of sales. Yeah, we're going to probably have less sales in 24 across DFW than what we did in 23. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to drop by about 5 to 8% lower. Mm-hmm. I think that's the influence of rates. I think rates influence that. Then again, you know, you get some people that maybe they have to sell because property taxes and insurance has gone through the roof, literally. Yes. And that could throw a kink in that. I expect lower sales this in 2024. That could throw a whole kink in that forecast.
Yeah. We did a whole show on that as well, the insurance and why all that's going on, because that's another thing that's just gone insane. But so a little bit back on the tax part a little bit, some of this to avoid people from having, or not avoid, but to help ease some of this. So I want you to talk a little bit about the process of arguing your taxes, okay? Because there's kind of two ways to do it, right? There is the, I'll do it by myself. I'll go in there and I'll, you know, bring my, whatever, my contract, whatever, your comps, whatever you think you're going to do, you're going to go to the office, try to do your thing. And then there's the other, I'm going to pay somebody to do it. Now, I'll tell you from I've been, you know, been in this business, my wife's a realtor, we've been doing it for 15 years, and I pay a guy every single year in Tarrant County to go argue my taxes. And what I tell people is, and you can correct me here, this is just what I say, I'm like, look, this guy that I pay, let's call him Bob, okay? Bob knows Jane, Susie, Bill, Louise, you know, Ralph, all at the tax office, because Bob used to work there. And Bob goes in with his stack of clients and Bob says, hey, I need this value for these. Here's the reason. They're like, cool, sounds good, you know, blah, blah, blah. All right. Well, I've lived in my home now for almost not quite 10 years, about eight years. You know, I bought it prior to 2019. And my value for what I bought my house might be somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 10% more than what I paid for it in that period of time because of this individual, which is fantastic. So probably shouldn't even be talking about it. But either way, how does that process work typically? And what do you recommend if people want to argue their value?
Okay, well, I can tell you this. I've got some very good friends at the appraisal districts myself. Mm-hmm. Go to lunch with them. I've argued and I've protested 3 times in my life. I've only won once.
Right.
Okay. I've walked away the other times with tail between my legs, no decrease whatsoever.
Yeah.
The 2 times that I lost, I took comps in. That's the first thing I thought. I'm going to get comps and take them in, and I'm going to argue. The appraisal district's ready for comps. What I found to be successful is whenever I'm going to go, if you and I are next door neighbors, mm-hmm. I want to prove, because they can't come into the house, they're not going to come in whenever they're valuing the property. I'm really not arguing against the appraisal district. I'm arguing saying your house, Mike, is the average house. I'm below average.
Right.
And here's why. And so I'm going to show pictures of maybe some problems with the back porch, you know, the concrete starting to buckle, or tree roots have grown up underneath, or maybe there's some tiles falling off of the pool. And I'm going to get estimates on how much it is to fix that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm taking in. Whenever I've gone in, I've sat down in front of the board and my buddy is going up against me and we're betting lunch on who's going to win. And I've had to pay twice and I've only gotten lunch bought once. So, you know, the average person, really, I mean, I don't know how to argue it as well as say Bob that you hired.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. They know the steps to take and how to really argue it. I can tell you a lot of times whenever I'm asked, the first thing that I do, I don't look at what is the value that you put on the structure. I want to see what is the value you put on the lot, on the dirt itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen some big discrepancies in neighborhoods on the value of the lot itself. And okay. If you're going to discount the dirt and you and I have the same size lot, why? And it's not really going in and getting upset at them. It's more, can you explain why this is such a different price?
Right.
And that is one tactic. Now, I'm also going to fall on, and a lot of people are not aware of this, but the appraisal districts, and I've gotten onto them for this because they don't tell the public.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that the appraisal districts are audited every 2 years for the price, the value that they give property in the entire district? They're audited by the comptroller.
The comptroller.
And if they're off by 5%, either over or under, they're given a warning and they get a visit the next year. If they're off again by 5%, they get a second warning and they get a third visit. If they're off again that third year, couple of things are going to probably happen. Number one, the chief appraiser is probably going to have to find a new job. Mm-hmm. And schools within the county, all school districts within the county start losing funding.
Wow. Really?
And so that kind of takes a little bit of the steam out of, we want to be so mad at the appraisal district. Look at the value we need them to be dead on with their appraisals.
Yeah.
Because if not, our
schools start suffering.
Well, okay, now what do we do? Who do we get mad at? I say we need to hammer those rates lower.
Yeah.
That's really where I would focus a lot of attention, is the rate needs to be lower. The rate. Because again, your property taxes are value, taxable value.
Yeah.
Times rate. And that's what determines your.
Well, I've heard, and I haven't really dug into this too much. I've just seen it in a couple spots, different articles and stuff. And you never know, you know, because it's the internet, so who knows? But I've seen where if there's a threshold, and I don't know exactly where it is, but like if you compare California to Texas and their state income tax versus our property tax, that once you get below a certain income level, that it actually starts to swing in our direction in the negative, that you're paying more in taxes to some extent for your property than you would in state income tax if you lived in California. As much as we villainize, look, I'm not a fan of California, but you know, as much as we villainize their state income tax and we champion the fact that we don't have one, I've seen a couple of people argue the point that once you get to a certain income level, which is more people than not, that that property tax amount actually impacts you less. Now, obviously, I guess with renters, it wouldn't be as big of a deal, but they're still paying for it because the landlords are, you know, passing that on. So have you heard that, or do you agree with that?
You know, I've seen it. I've been asked by some people that were potentially looking at moving here to estimate what is the property tax, you know, because they couldn't get kind of a straight answer.
Yeah.
They wanted to see what are our estimated property taxes? The last one that I did was for a couple that were retired and they were living in a $1.6 million house in California. And they were looking at moving to Texas in the Metroplex because children were here and grandchildren were here. So they were going to cut the value in half. They were taking a lot of equity out of California and they were going to buy about an $850,000 house here. The location where they wanted to put in an offer, I estimated their property taxes are going to be about $25,000. They got quiet on the phone and said, that's a lot more than what we were thinking.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, your property taxes are definitely high. And I, just like any good Texan, I said, but we don't have a state income tax. And their response was, we're retired. Our state income tax total for property taxes for them plus state income tax last year was about $11,000 total.
Wow.
For them. Now they were retired. So I was going, I don't know as a good Texan how I defend my state now. you know, so yeah, there's certain situations and certain thresholds where absolutely it's going to be cheaper to have that state income tax. Sure, it will. Yeah. Going to be other situations where no, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's all over the board.
Just
so tell me how you want to argue it, and then we can find the demographic that support your argument.
Honestly. Right. Give me two numbers, and I'll tell you. Yeah, I'll tell you what you want to hear.
Tell me what you want. Tell me what you want to hear.
So speaking of the old folks out there, not to, you know, any of the over 65 folks, we talked about this in the very beginning.
Some of us might be getting closer to that.
Yeah.
Every day.
I'm not that far off, by the way. I'm not too far off. I'm 45, so we're not that far off, but I'm closer to it than I was the other side of it. So that's for sure.
I'm 9 years closer than you are. So.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We're getting there. Hey, look, we have something to look forward to. So, okay. I want you to talk about this little, we'll call it a tax hack. Okay. So if you're over 65 or getting there, okay, this is a great way for you to really save money on taxes, and it's completely legal, correct?
Absolutely. It is.
There's nothing wrong with this. And
it's on the comptroller's website.
Yes. So, but I don't think very many people understand this, and you can actually plan. If you know this little trick, you can actually plan for your retirement pretty effectively and save a dramatic amount of money on any kind of property taxes and live, oh, by the way, in a really nice home. So explain how that works exactly.
Okay. Well, number one, your homestead in the year that you turned 65, your homestead, the value of that homestead is frozen. And so it does not move. The tax rate can change, but the homestead's value is frozen. Now, and I don't know why, but my Google assistant, hey, Google, stop. I don't know why my Google assistant was going on.
It's always just listening. they heard you were going to comment on the school taxes, and they were like, what are you going to say, Blake?
Probably so.
We're listening.
Probably so. Anyway. The value of your home freezes in the year that you turn 65. Market value keeps going up, but you're frozen. So the longer you stay in the home, the more the market goes up, you've got a percentage savings. You would be paying market value property taxes, but you're not. You're frozen down here. So you've got a percentage savings. Now you decide to move. That percentage savings you can move and transfer to your new home. So if you're saving 35% in school property taxes on the home you're living in, you move into a new home, the market value will be dropped by 35% and frozen there. And so key is you have to be moving one Texas residence to another, and you have to ask for it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know about this transfer of percentages. You will go to the appraisal district where you're moving from, tell them you're moving, and tell them you need the transfer certificate. You move into the new home, update your driver's license, and give the new appraisal district your transfer certificate, and you're done.
So it's a percentage, not a value, right?
Exactly right. Yes, it is a percentage. And yeah, there's some counties in Texas where the median home price is less than the total amount of exemptions that we get. Because remember, our school property taxes, we're getting $100,000 now. Mm-hmm. Exemption. That means you take the value of your home, subtract off $100,000 immediately before you calculate property taxes. You get an additional $10,000 for being over 65. So if you happen to be lucky enough to live in a home that's valued under $110,000 by the appraisal district, yeah, you've got more exemptions than you do value. So the value for calculating school taxes is $0. So okay. You won't pay taxes.
So, all right. So let's say that scenario. So let's say, help me understand. So if I live in my house right now, like the house that I have here, and then let's say I buy a house in West Texas, that's like 150 grand. Okay. And tomorrow I rent it out. I buy it. I'm still living where I'm at, right? I'm 45. I got some time. I buy that house. I'm renting it out to somebody else. When I turn, let's say 62, all right, because I'm going to do a little earlier. I turn 62. I decide to move to that house and take my homestead there. Okay. And then apply my homestead, stay there till I'm 65. Obviously, I'm going to live there for 3 years, take my over 65. And then after that, I decide to move either back to where I'm at now or somewhere else. Okay. In that scenario, how much of a percentage am I taking with me when I go?
Okay. So what did you say the value was whenever you declared homestead in Texas?
Let's say it's 200,000 just for easy.
Okay. 200,000. How much did the market go up from the time that you turned 65 until you moved? Move back or move to East Texas.
So let's say I moved to there and I at 62 and I bought it for 200,000. And then let's say by the time I turned 65, it was worth 215.
Okay. So it's 215. You're going to freeze it 215. Mm-hmm. Now, how much is it going to go up from the time that you freeze it? How much is it going to go up till you move? Is it going to go up 10%? Is it going to go up 12?
Let's say 10.
Then you'll get to move that 10% with you.
Okay. So what it is then is the, once you turn 65, okay, that freezes. And then the percentage that the house increases after you turn 65, that percentage you take with you wherever you move.
Yes, exactly right.
So if your home appreciates by 30%, again, after you turn 65 and it's frozen, so you're not taking the value, you're just taking the percentage of the difference in the value.
Yes, okay. Exactly right. And anybody that turned 65 in the last 3 or 4 years, they have got a massive percentage savings right now, built up. Even if you turn 65 in 2020, imagine how much of a massive buildup you already have.
So if I was at my house now and I turned 60, if I stayed here for another 20 years and I turned 65 living here, okay, and I had my 10% cap that I've had since I've been here, and let's say I've keep arguing my values and held it down. And let's say that the difference between what my taxable value is versus what my actual market value is 40% when I turn 65. I take that with me?
The market value is what freezes.
Okay. Gotcha.
So on the year that you turn 65, your market value freezes.
But the market value according to the county.
Yeah, exactly. And so if your taxable value, if you're still working off a 10% increase, it can keep going up until it hits that frozen market value.
So the true benefit then in this is being in your home when you're 65 and then the market appreciating relatively dramatically in a 3 to 5 or 6 year period or whatever, and then moving after that, because that's when you're going to get the biggest benefit.
The key is home ownership in the year that you turn 65.
Gotcha. Okay.
Absolutely.
That makes sense. Okay. Very good. Well, I mean, look, it's any way that you can, especially when you get into retirement age, if you're on fixed incomes or you're living off your retirement, if we'll see if Social Security's around. I mean, they keep saying I think when I was growing up, they said it'd be gone by now, but it's still there somehow. I don't know how, but we'll see if that's even existing by the time we get there. But either way, fixed incomes, once you get to a certain age, people are living longer. You know, these are big benefits, you know, and truly, you know, I think people with just looking at lifespan, I mean, you know, nowadays people are living quite a bit longer with healthcare and everything that's working out. And when you're, you know, we talk about retiring at 65, I mean, look, you're 9 years away from it. Are you, or less, do you see yourself quote retiring, like just playing golf every day when you're 65 years old?
No, as long as I'm enjoying it, as long as I'm having fun and, you know, the people keep it fun, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep going because I enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's always big savings whenever, or a helpful thing, especially for older folks, you know, having these rules in place in the state. Is this unique to the state of Texas or is this other places as well?
I've, I've got my hands full keeping up with the state of Texas and everything that goes on here. I haven't even looked outside of Texas. I do know that it, you know, that rule as far as transferring the percentages, it can only be one Texas residence to another.
It
applies for school districts across the state. So if you're moving from Amarillo to Beaumont, yes, you can do the transfer for school tax purposes. Within a county, if a county recognizes the freeze, they don't have to, but if they do and you stay within the county, then you can transfer for county tax purposes as well.
Wow.
If it's within the city and the city recognizes it, the freeze, you can transfer within the, you know, your percentages for the city as well.
Yeah.
But again, schools, it's mandatory anywhere in the state of Texas that you move.
Well, it's, I think it'd be a big benefit too if you're older and you're downsizing, because if you're downsizing from where you were to the new place, your taxes are already going down because you're having less of an expensive home. And then you're also carrying over that exemption and you're carrying over the frozen percentage that you get to keep it. So that's where the true benefit comes in play.
Exactly right. Yes, absolutely. And my mother, whenever she retired, she moved to the Metroplex to be closer from West Texas. And so she actually upsized. And I can tell you that had this option not been available, my mother would have likely not moved. Yeah. And, you know, she's at the age where she needs to be close. And she wanted to. Yeah. She wanted to see my children, you know, in the last years that they were in high school, and them to just drive out and have lunch with her.
Yeah.
It would have taken 5 hours to get to her otherwise, or it did whenever she lived in West Texas. So now my children were able to just drive out and have lunch with their grandmother, which That's was awesome. Great.
Yeah.
That little catch, that rule enabled my mother to move to the Metroplex and live, not just live down here.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, Blake, we're at an hour. It goes by quickly. So, but I really appreciate all your information, man. And, you know, like I said, in the very beginning, nobody ever likes to talk about taxes, but you know, we have to understand how they work. We have to understand the mechanics of it. You know, when these taxable values go up, you know, what can affect it, especially when you're buying a home, to understand it. Are my taxes going to go up in the next 12 to 24 months? You need to ask these questions. As a realtor, you need to ask these questions of the lender. You need to look for yourself to see what the actual taxable value is. You know, I often, whenever agents will send me listings, like, here's what the taxes are, I say, look, politely, I'm going to go look them up myself, because I don't, you know, because they don't look for the exemptions. You just go and looking for that amount. You see that, oh, there's taxes only $2,500 on this $500,000 house. And you're like, well, that's because they have
There's a reason why. Yep.
Yes.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So you just have to know all these things and you have to do your due diligence, and you know, and it's something that is going to save you money in the long term, but if at minimum, it's going to be able to set your expectations on what's coming, so you don't get blindsided by these big bills and you can be ready.
Absolutely right. Don't get caught off guard. You know exactly what it is. So I couldn't agree more.
Well, Blake, thank you so much. Anything else you want to say anything before we roll out of here?
You bet there is. I love your shirt. You wear that in the honor of opening day.
That's right. It's opening day today. It's time for some baseball. Exactly. I'm excited. Right. Now, if I could just figure out how to watch the damn thing without having to subscribe to freaking Time Warner Cable or DirecTV. It's the most frustrating thing. I can't even tell you. And I don't know how there's not a bigger uproar about it, because I haven't had cable or satellite for like 5 or 6 years. Like, mm-hmm. I use YouTube. I would pay Bally Sports. I would pay them $25 a month or whatever it is, so I could just watch the Rangers and the Mavs. And I can't. And it's the most, I keep my F-bombs to a minimum on that statement. But yes.
I mean, we could go for another hour if you want to keep it. Keep on.
No, it burns me up, man. It burns me up. But yes, it is baseball time again, and I'm super excited. I've, you know, been a Ranger fan since I was a little kid, and last year was like the best year ever. You know, going through that run, and I can't wait. Like, I haven't been so excited for baseball in so long. So I'm stoked. And yes, I will be. I won't be at the game today because I've got children and they have practices and all that fun stuff, but I will be sitting on a baseball field with my phone watching. So that's where I will be. No, it is a nationally televised game today, so I get to watch this one. The rest of them I don't get to do.
Exactly right. But you know what? It's the greatest time of the year. It's the greatest time of year.
That's right. I agree.
Everybody has a shot today.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, it does. And we got a good shot for the rest of the year too. So I won't be depressed come May like I usually am. So it'll be good. All right, Blake. Well, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for hopping on with me. And thanks for everybody that stuck around. And I will be back next week. We are going to be doing a little bit of AI talk regarding how to, you know, with all these commissions changes that have happened in the real estate industry, you know, streamlining your processes and making things a little less expensive and handling certain steps along the way is going to be a big benefit. And great news is there's an incredible technology that can do it all for you. And we're going to talk about that next week. So everybody have a great weekend and go Rangers, and I'll see you next time.